obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.
Melanie adjusted this for me already. Hi, my name is Kathy.
Hi, Kathy.
And I am a very grateful member of this worldwide fellowship. I am so grateful to be a part of this program. I entered this program in Anchorage, Alaska, and I moved to back down to Southern California about 20 years ago. So I've gotten to see a lot of different ways of celebrating and being a part of recovery. And you know, I started off in an alcoholic home, like a lot of us have. My dad was the alcoholic, and my mother was somebody who I really wished would find Al-Anon. And it was just a, you know, it was a crazy alcoholic household. My dad managed to, like, crash 4 cars in the space of about 6 months, and after that, my parents decided maybe they should move to California. They were living in New York at the time. And so we moved to Southern California, and you know, their marriage didn't work out. His drinking continued, and her nagging and yelling and wanting it to all be different continued. And so they got divorced, but first they had my little brother and my little sister. So at the time they got divorced, I was 11, I guess. My brother was 4, and my little sister was 2. And my little sister was terminally ill. She had leukemia. And so in addition to having alcoholism in our household, we had this illness that caused us to spend a lot of focus on either my dad, the alcoholic, or my little sister, the sick one. And so I became the caretaker. You know, I started taking care of everyone. I took care of my little sister. I took care of my brother when my mom had to be at the hospital with my sister. And I tried to take care of my parents. I learned how to stuff my feelings and take care of theirs. I can remember that when my sister died, I remember being at the funeral service, and I was extremely sad, but I didn't know how to show that sadness. And instead, I was worried about my mom and my dad. How were they going to survive? Especially my dad, because by that time, they were already divorced, and he was all alone. And I wanted to fix it for him. You know, I started out at 12 years old. I wanted to fix it for him. And I continued that history for a long time. My parents did get divorced, and, you know, I was going to school, and pretty soon I was in high school, and, you know, the boys I was always attracted to were those that needed somebody to help take care of them. They were exciting, they were dynamic, and there was just one little thing about them that maybe if I could just fix it. And so when I was a senior in high school, I started dating this boy that I had lived next door to at one time. And, you know, he was this great guy, and there was just this one problem. He liked to smoke pot. And I thought, I don't really like it that he smokes pot, you know? So I remember going to him and saying, you either have to give up smoking pot or we're done. And he said, bye. I said, well, wait a minute. Let's think about this. And so I learned how to smoke pot. You know, it was like I would do anything. I became that chameleon that would do anything to get you to love me, whatever it would take. That same boyfriend moved up to Alaska, and he started writing to me and telling me how much he loved it there, and he loved me, and so I should join him. And so when I was 19 years old, I jumped on an airplane, and I moved to Anchorage, Alaska. And I loved it there. It was beautiful. It was this new frontier. I lived in a household with 4 guys and me. It was heaven. You know, I loved the attention. I've always loved the attention. And I had all of these people to take care of. I did all the laundry. I kept the house clean, you know, until I sat down and I figured out I wasn't really getting paid a very good hourly wage. And so I stayed up there. That relationship didn't work, but I loved Alaska, and I stayed there, and so I went to work in the Alaska Pipeline. That was really a dream come true. There we had 10 men to every one woman, and I was in heaven, you know? And believe me, there was a lot of drinking and drugging that went on up there, and I met this man, and he was another one of those charismatic, exciting men, and he drank, but you know, he didn't drink like my dad did. My dad sat at home, you know, he mostly drank beer, he wasn't really a partier, and I knew that my dad drank too much. But this guy was fun, you know, he was exciting. He liked to go out, he liked to party, and I didn't make the connection, you know. He was different than my dad, so it wasn't going to be the same. He happened to have I guess she was five at the time, a five-year-old daughter. And, you know, sometimes looking back, I'm not sure what I wanted more, him or the daughter. And so we got married, and I gained a husband and a daughter. So now I'm 23 years old, and I'm married, and I have a five-year-old, almost six. And you know what? It's not so fun when they're a partier, when you're married and you have children. It's not so fun when they go out and they don't come home at the time they say they're going to, and you know, first it's a few hours late, and then it's a few more hours late, and pretty soon they're gone all night. And I didn't like it much. And I was one of those window watchers. You know, I'd do that little path, and I'd come back to the window, and I'd look, see if he was there yet, and I'd walk, and I'd come back, and you know, I was really busy watching to find that alcoholic and waiting for him to get home. I don't know if I thought I could will him to come home by looking out that window. So then we lived in Portland for a little while. We ended up going back to California. I got pregnant a couple of times, and I lost those babies. They were both born alive, and within 11 months, I lost two babies. And again, I don't do grief at this point in my life. I don't know how to do grief. And so I just stuffed the feelings and took care of everybody else. Is everybody else okay? Because that was the only way I knew how to do it at the time. So then we got transferred through his job up to Juneau, Alaska. Now, Juneau, Alaska has 40 miles of road. It is a peninsula surrounded on three sides by water and the other side by mountain. So you don't go far. Every other corner is a bar and the other corner is a church. And so here we are, we're just fit right in. My husband got there and he was a chef by trade, and so he was working in a hotel restaurant, and he ended up becoming the union rep for the Hotel Motel Restaurant and Bartenders Union. Perfect for him. He had to go to all the bars and all the restaurants to collect the dues. The sad part was usually the dues ended up coming out of his paycheck because somehow or other they never quite made it back to the office. And this was like the first time, you know, that I started suspecting that, you know, well, not the first time, but it was like I started thinking I needed to do something. It was like I didn't want to live this way, and I didn't know what to do. I actually attended my very first Al-Anon meeting in Juneau, Alaska. It was a really dark, snowy night, and this friend and I both had decided that we had husbands who had problems, and so we went to this meeting. There were two other people in the meeting, and the entire hour they let us talk about our alcoholics. We left there and thought, we don't really need to go out to do that. We could do that at home. And so it took another 2 years before I found Al-Anon and got to stay. I decided at that time that I needed to leave. It was the first of many times that I decided I needed to leave. And my stepdaughter decided she wanted to go with me. And so we left Juneau and we moved to Anchorage. And of course, he came following us and told us it would be different, and he would be different, and he wouldn't drink, and, you know, and every time he said that, I really wanted to believe him. You know, it's like our thing says, you know, each time there is a sober period, we want to believe. And so then I got pregnant again, and, you know, I was scared. I was really scared. I was trying to do everything I needed to because I really wanted this baby, and so at 6 months, they told me I had to go on bed rest. Well, you know, it's really hard to be on bed rest when you have a 10-year-old daughter and a husband who drinks too much. But I tried. My dear mother moved up to Alaska so that she could help me. And that made it harder, you know. I was constantly trying to be the peacemaker, you know. My mother and my former husband just had a really tough time together. And so I can remember him calling in the middle of the night, and he'd be somewhere, and he needed a ride home. And I'd get up and I'd go get him, because as much as I wanted that baby, I wanted that man more. Luckily, my higher power decided to take care of all of us, and that baby girl is sitting over there. And I am so grateful. We called her my miracle baby for a really long time. She came a little bit early, not too much, and we were off. And so she was about a year old, and my husband had gone back to work, working on the pipeline. And so he was gone for 9 weeks at a time, and he'd be home for two. Except he didn't always make it home right at the end of his 9 weeks. He'd like stop off in Fairbanks, and we wouldn't hear from him. I didn't know where he was. He could disappear for, a week, 10 days. And this last time that happened, I ended up going to see a therapist, and this therapist told me that I needed to tell him that he couldn't come home unless he went into treatment. And I for some reason at that time, I had the willingness to do that. And so when he finally called, I told him, "You can't come home. You can't come home unless you're willing to do something about this, because this isn't okay." And of course he agreed, because he always agreed. And so he came home, and he went into a 30-day treatment facility. And the really wonderful thing about this treatment facility is that they had a family week. And at that family week, there was a meeting in Anchorage that every Thursday they brought a group to this family week, and they invited the members to come back with them that night to the meeting. And I went. And it was, in a church basement. We always get the church basement. And I went in there, and at that time, all I could relate to was people who had the same situation I did. So, I was really relating to the people who had spouses in treatment, not so much anybody else. But, there was something there. There was something there that got me to keep going back. That was November 9th of 1981. And so I kept going back, and, Anchorage was little. We had, at that time, I think there were only about 6 meetings a week. But I kept going back to this particular meeting, and they didn't talk about sponsors much, and, they kept talking about this thing about work in a program, and I kept saying, "Well, what does that mean?" And I asked a couple of people to be my sponsor. I remember calling this one lady, and she didn't call me back, so I said, "Forget that." And then my spouse went in and out of drinking. He had a really tough time, and he went back out. And then he went into another treatment facility. And at that treatment facility, I met this woman who had something I wanted. She had been a member of Al-Anon for a while, and our stories were not the same at all. I was married and had children. She'd never been married at that time and certainly had no children. But she had that something. She had that peace and serenity, and she was happy in her life. And, by that time, I wasn't very happy in my life. My world just kept getting smaller and smaller and smaller until, it was just surrounded my family. I was working, and I'd go to work every day, and then I'd be at home, and, I was always trying to keep it all settled. So at this point, that husband is sober, and now I have a sponsor who's now making me get in shape and, working the steps and being of service, because she totally believed that you went to meetings, you worked the steps, and you were of service, and that was how you got recovery in this program. See, I finally found out how do you work a program. And so I started to get involved in service at that time, and my spouse was sober, and now my stepdaughter, who by that time is getting into her teen years, all of a sudden she's starting to run away, she's starting to drink and use and do all kinds of crazy things, and one more time, my heart was just breaking. It's like, no, this can't be happening to my child. It's like, it's one thing if it's your husband, and that's not fun. But this is my child who I raised. I didn't want her to be alcoholic. I didn't want her to have a problem. And I remember she ran away and went to live with her mom for a while. And I was heartbroken when that happened. And they still didn't have a lot of Al-Anon meetings, so I was going to open AA meetings and just sitting there and just crying. Because, finally that dam is starting to break. That grief that I never felt. When you start feeling it, you get to feel it. And so she kind of went off on her own for a bit. I ended up, my spouse went back to drinking again, and I didn't want to live that way anymore. And so one more time, he disappeared. He was gone for like 9 days. And when he called me up, I told him, "You can't come home. And there was no ultimatum. You just can't come home. And I had one of my sponsees was sitting at the kitchen table with me at the time he called, and I know my higher power put her there. So he asked if he could come home and get some of his stuff, and without my calling anyone, a second sponsee showed up at my house. And so that when he came, I had two sponsees sitting there with me, and he looked horrible. He was beat up. It was awful. Everything in me wanted to take care of him, and I knew I couldn't do it. I knew that I had to let him go. And so he did move out, and, you know, he one more time tried to get sober, and, you know, one more time we were trying, we were dating, we were doing this and that, and I got to that place where I knew it didn't matter. It didn't matter if he drank or not, that it just wasn't the best place for me. And, you know, I had worked the steps around my marriage. I had turned it over. I remember asking my sponsor, how many times do I have to turn this over? She'd say, one more time, then you take it back. And so I kept turning it over. And so this one day, in fact, it was Easter Sunday, he was cooking breakfast at our house, and I did something he didn't like, and he cussed at me in Spanish. It was something that he used to do. And I remember just sitting there and thinking, it's always going to be like this. It's not going to be any different. And it was like, it was just the catalyst that I needed. And I decided that I no longer needed to be in that marriage. And that, you know, I kept turning it over. And one of the things was, I didn't want to be divorced. I didn't want to end my marriage. I wanted that marriage to work. You know, my mom was divorced twice. My dad, I don't even know how many times. I didn't want to be divorced. And so I realized that I kept presupposing I knew what God's will for me was. I believed that God's will for me was to stay in this marriage, and I just kept waiting for him to show me how to do it. And when I finally let go, when I finally trusted God, I realized that it wasn't where he wanted me. And so I left that marriage, and it wasn't easy. You know, it was painful. I was sad. But it was okay. And so now I'm on my own. The older daughter is out on her own. It's just me and Melanie, and we're living in Anchorage. And I'm starting to realize maybe I don't really want to live here. And so I came down here. I went to my high school reunion down here. And for the first time since I had moved to Alaska, I thought, well, maybe I want to come home. You know, I still had family down here. My mom, who had come up to Alaska for a while, was now back down here in Bakersfield. And so I made the decision that I was ready to move here. And so I came back down to Southern California. Now, I'd been in program for 10 years by then. I actually got to be Alaska's delegate to the World Service Conference. I served for 2 years. I had all these things there, but I was time to move, you know. And again, I did what I learned here. I worked the steps on this process. I used the steps to make major decisions in my life, and I realized it was time to go. So we came down here, and it's hard to move. You know, it's hard to walk into a meeting and everybody doesn't know you. It's hard to, like, reconnect and rebuild and do all that stuff. And it took me a little while to do that. I was really grateful because that first sponsor had moved down to Oceanside. And so for a little while, I was living in Huntington Beach, and we would go and we would meet in Laguna. And we'd go to this Wednesday night meeting in Laguna. We'd have dinner, go to this meeting. But, you know, I wasn't getting into any place where I was, like, talking to people. I was doing that old thing, you know, go to the meeting late, leave early, don't talk to anybody. And I knew that I was thinking, and I needed to do something. And, you know, one more time she kicked my butt and said, you know, you need to get involved. And I found a Tuesday night meeting in Huntington Beach where they didn't have a GR. So I raised my hand, and I became that GR. And it was the beginning of connecting me to Southern California. I should say I was really fortunate. For those of you who knew Hester from down in San Diego, she was one of the people that I met at conference. And when I did move here, she took me under her wing. She was this really special soul to me. So I've got like these little angels all around. So I'm here for a while, and you know, I'm doing relationships, and I'm not doing them very well, and you know, I'm still trying to find that person. And I came from an alcoholic home, so, you know, my dad always held me at arm's length. And so every relationship I got into for a long time, that's how it was. I was held at arm's length. And it's not fun being in a relationship that you're making happen and you're doing all the work. And But I kept trying it until finally I thought, you know what? I just need to work on me. I just need to be okay with me. At the same time, my lovely daughter was doing her own experimenting. She was supposed to be my perfect little Al-Anon, and she wasn't. And you know, it's really hard when you have somebody who's so like you that all of a sudden when they start doing things that are not like you, it's very hard to understand. And so I went through, you know, another phase of, oh my gosh, don't I have enough alcoholics in my life? And so she kept going, and there, you know, we had some trials there. We had, I can remember having to drive to Joshua Tree to go and pick her up because the Rangers called me. They had her in custody. And I remember being up all night and having to show up at the assembly the next day. So I show up at the assembly, and I am like, I am in tears. I am devastated. And I have all these older Al-Anon women saying, oh, she's just right where she's supposed to be. It'll be okay. I'm like, you are crazy. But you know what? We managed to get through. And I'm really grateful today that that she has found AA and that she's been sober for almost 8 years, 7 years. Jeez. Anyway, I'm just grateful for that. You know, she was involved in Alateen for a long time, and I'm really grateful for her time in Alateen. When she left Alateen, I became an Alateen sponsor. I got to sponsor SCAC. I got to do a lot of things that I never thought I would. And, you know, I was grateful. Melanie was going away to school, and, you know, it had just been she and I for a long time. And I was afraid, you know, a little bit about being by myself. And so I ended up as SCAC co-sponsor, and so I wasn't at all by myself. And all these teenagers, a lot of the time. So we'll fast forward a little, and, you know, Melanie ends up getting sober, and my older daughter is still having difficulties. You know, she did okay for a little while, and she had a daughter, Sierra, and she was maintaining, and then all of a sudden she was no longer maintaining, and they were in Alaska, and I will tell you, it is much easier to detach when you are 4,000 miles away. But I would still hear all the stories, and then she got pregnant with my grandson, Ryan, and then she got pregnant with my granddaughter, Rochelle. But in the meantime, things are happening, and social service is starting to come in, and they're taking the children away, and there's just all this drama going on. You know, again, I'm still detaching for the most part. I'm not really sure what to do. In fact, actually, I guess Rochelle wasn't born yet. There's another really important piece of my story. Melanie's dad, my former husband, got into a drinking incident. And to this day, we don't know whether he had a stroke and stopped breathing or he stopped breathing and had a stroke. But we got a call that he was in a coma. And this is one of the miracles of this program, that when we got that call and I told Melanie that we needed to go up there because they weren't sure how long he was going to last, that I could do that, and I could do it with no animosity, with a lot of compassion. I could do that and go and be there for my girls. And so Melanie asked me at that time, are you sure we need to go right now? Because you know, and it's like, you know, it's so hard to tell somebody what the reality is. And I told her, yes, we really do need to go. And so we went up to Alaska, and he was indeed in a coma. He was in a coma for 7 days, and we all, for that whole 7 days, went back and forth to the hospital, and we'd go, and we took turns being able to go in there, and I got to go in there, and, you know, I got to, well, part of me yelled at him, you know, I got to yell at him and tell him how pissed I was that one more time he was leaving me to do it all, you know, but I also got to tell him the things that I was grateful for, the things that he had brought to his children, and when it came time to make the decision to remove the breathing tube, I got to be there with my girls because they're the ones that had to make that choice. And it was a really tough choice. It was a tough choice for all of us. And I have to tell you that after he died, I was really kind of surprised at the effect that it had on me because I was really sad. I was really, really sad. And I had a tough time for a while, a really tough time. And then Melanie went off to Arizona, and then I got to be SCAC sponsor. And there just are no mistakes. You know, life God just is there for me every step of the way, and I really believe that there are no accidents. You know, it just kind of happens that way. So my granddaughter Rochelle was born 10 days before her grandfather died. So I spent that time up there holding her pretty much the whole 2 weeks that we were up there. And I knew that, you know, it wasn't good, you know, and now I have to see it firsthand because I'm there, and it's not good. I got to go to the meeting that I helped start while I was up there for his funeral and spending time. I was so grateful. I walked into this meeting, and there were only 7 people there, and 5 of them were people I had known when I lived there. You know, it's like we're home wherever we are. So I start hearing these reports, and finally, there's this report that they have left the state, and that they took their 2 kids. Sierra was now living with her dad. This was a different dad for the other 2 kids. And they'd left the state because they didn't want the state to take their kids. Only Alaska pursued them and found them and filed felony charges on them. And so when they got back to Alaska, I got this call from the social worker that said, you know, would you be willing to take these children? And I'm like, huh? Because at the time, they would have been 3 and 7. I'm like, oh my gosh. And when I got to tell that social worker, after doing a lot of work, getting on my knees, asking for guidance, talking to my sponsor, I told her, I said, you know, what I want to do is whatever is best for those children. You know, so, because in my mind, I'm thinking, you know, if there's a family with a mom and a dad, that's the best place for them, not with, you know, old grandma. And so as it went on, in the meantime, like I said, my higher power really takes care of me, and I reconnected with someone I went to high school with. And in fact, we reconnected over this whole conversation about my getting the kids. And he was amazingly supportive. And in July of that year, Orange County was making it really tough for me to get these children. I was living in a 2-bedroom apartment, Melanie and I, and they said we needed 2 more bedrooms, 1 for each of the children. And I'm like, you know, I'm working as a, you know, for social services in Orange County. I'm a single parent, have been forever, and I don't make the kind of money to go and rent a 4-bedroom place. And so this amazing angel said that he would like to help us. And so he flew out here, and we hadn't seen each other in 34 years. And we connected, you know, we just connected. We spent that entire weekend just talking, and he helped me to put the down payment on this place that we could move into so that I could get these children. And he and I have spoken every day since that day, which was July 30th of 2005. So the wheels are in motion. In the meantime, we find out that my daughter's pregnant again. And I'm just like, oh my gosh. And so Alaska really, in many ways, bent over backwards for her. And so they were willing to let her try to keep the baby so long as she did it in conjunction with me. So in December of that year, I get these 2 children. They're now 4 and 8. And they come down. And their mom came down and spent a month with us. But she was on probation, so she had to go back up to Alaska. And the baby had to go with her. But now I have the baby in my house for a month. He was born in September, so he was like 3 months old, and I spent a lot of that time holding him and just being with him. And so they go back up to Alaska, and in April, she showed up for her, well, she had a dirty UA. So they immediately took the baby, and guess who gets another phone call? Are you willing to take the baby? The baby is 10 months old at this time. Well, he's not even 10 months. He's 6 months old at the time. And I am like, oh my gosh. And I said, yes. And so that was in April. He didn't arrive until July. And so now I have a 10-month-old. I have a 5-year-old. And I have a 9-year-old. Now, my baby is 31 years old now. So it was definitely a shock to my system, and I'm telling you that without this program, there's no way I could have done it. Without continuing to go to meetings, without being able to talk to a sponsor, without trusting that my higher power was going to take care of us. That's the part that did it. And, you know, for the most part, I've stayed involved in service, and I believe that is one of the things that keeps me in this program, is being involved in service. And so Dom was willing to be a part of our life and committed to raising these children with me. And after about 6 weeks of having all three of them, after the baby got here, who, by the way, still wasn't sleeping through the night, I was working a full-time job, and so I called Dom up this one day. I had hit a wall. I was in tears. Everywhere I went, I was crying. And I called him up, and I just said, I can't do this, and I'm not willing to give up the kids. And so he told me I could quit my job, and he started to help support me, and I got to be a stay-at-home mom. And, you know, I have to tell you, there's been a lot of levels of acceptance on being mom again at this age, a lot of levels. It's like, you know, when I first started doing it, I think I still thought, you know, she'll get her act together, they'll go back with her. You know, it was like I didn't totally accept that now I was mom again. Because I will tell you that it has totally and definitely changed my life. I was single, and I had an adult child, and I could go and do whatever I wanted to, basically. You know, if I had the money and the time, I could go do it. And, you know, to now have three small children, that all changed. At the time, Dom was living in Texas, and we maintained a long-distance relationship for a while, and you know, so it was me and these kids, and Melanie was living at home still, and she was and still is a tremendous amount of help. She still comes and babysits once a week so that Dom and I can have a date night, which is, let me tell you, amazing. The idea of being able to get out. But I find myself, you know, in just these levels of acceptance, you know, just one foot in front of the other. It's like, so these days, I find myself so much more involved in things. My kids do soccer. They do baseball. You know, we're at the baseball field. We're at the soccer field. And about, gosh, it's almost 4 years ago now, Dom decided that he was going to move out here and totally make that commitment to be with us. And so he was here. And I told you about that sponsor of mine that had moved to Oceanside. And while when I moved here, she didn't really become my sponsor again, we remained really close. She was somebody I talked to all the time. And she had breast cancer. She was diagnosed in 1995. And this woman who taught me how to live taught me how to die. And so she was amazing. She had the most positive attitude of anybody I've ever known. She was sick. Her hair was gone. She had all these crazy treatments going on. And yet she went to her meetings. You know, she went and did life. She never said, why me? You know, she never said, why is this happening? And I'm so grateful that I traveled that journey with her. In fact, she went with us to the 2005 International in Toronto, and I'm so grateful that that worked out and that she was there with us. So she was really sick, and it kind of went really fast near the end, and I got to be there with her, you know? I got to be there with her when she took her last breath, and I got to walk through that journey with her. And she was amazing. She was absolutely amazing. And, you know, to this day, I miss her a lot because, you know, she knew all parts of me. And I could call her up and we would just start talking about anything. And it took like almost a year before I stopped trying to pick up the phone to call her. You know, it was like, and there are still days when I think, oh, I should tell Karen. And so, you know, this program then too, you know, with the grief and the sadness and, you know, and now I feel grief. Let me tell you, the grief now certainly shows up. And yet this program's always there for me. You know, it helps me to know what I'm powerless over. It helps me to know I have a higher power, and it helps me to have a relationship with a higher power. Because when I got here, I was raised in a religious home. I went to Catholic school. And I believed in God, but I didn't have a relationship with God. And I got here, and I developed a relationship. I came to believe that my higher power cared about all parts of my life, you know, and that I used to say, you know, God was up there, and I was down here, and we didn't meet much. And now I don't feel that way at all. You know, I talk to my higher power all the time, and I just feel extremely close to that higher power, and I believe all the time that he's guiding me and helping me. And, you know, it's not always easy. There are days when I wonder, what the hell am I doing raising three kids at 58 years old? It's like, oh my gosh. And, you know, because this body is, like, really tired, I keep telling people that, you know, I think things start, like, getting out of whack because you're not supposed to be taking care of little kids at 58. But maybe they just get out of whack anyway. And so some days it's tough. And, you know, my kids are not easy kids. You know, when we got them, the little boy constantly wanted to know what he was going to have to eat next. He was constantly wanting to make sure that he was going to be fed. And the little girl didn't know how to talk. Instead, every time she wanted something, she screamed it or screeched it. You know, she'd be in the back seat of my car and she'd say it was hot, except she wouldn't just say it's hot. She'd go, it's hot. And they're not like that today, you know? They still have their difficulties, but they're not like that today. They're active, they're a part of life, and, you know, I get to see the changes that have happened in them, and I get to see the changes that have happened in me. You know, I got to, I get to be a part of their school life, you know. Dom and I participated in Colonial Day a couple weeks ago, and it was fun. It was like, you know, and I realized that there's a whole part of me that I just kind of kept pulling myself back. And I think it was, gosh, I don't even remember, but I adopted these children. They're mine. They're not going anywhere. And sometimes that's easier than at others, you know? They're still attached to their mom. Their mom is still in our lives. I believe that she is clean and sober today. I'm hoping that she is. I don't see any signs that she's not. But, you know, she has her own difficulties, and I realize all the time that the kids are where they're supposed to be, and that I'm glad that she gets to participate with us. But I don't know that she could raise them. I really don't know that she could raise them. And you know, so I'm thankful all the time that God gives me the strength and the willingness, and somehow or other the wherewithal to take care of these kids. I have to every day say, okay, God, please show us what we're going to do today, and please give me the willingness and the strength to do it. Because I couldn't do it otherwise. I couldn't do it without my higher power. It would just be too crazy. We recently had another scare go on. The kid's mom discovered that she had stomach cancer. And, you know, I've already walked through cancer with somebody. And I, you know, my first reaction these days is I kind of pull back. I kind of protect myself because it is so easy to be hurt. And I didn't want to believe it, you know. I go through like this process, you know, where it's like I hear it. It's that whole, the three A's, you know. First I have to acknowledge it. And it's like, it takes me some time of like talking about it and being with people and until I get to that place where I accept it, you know. And I had to get into acceptance that she had stomach cancer. And I didn't know what that was going to be like. And again, she now lives in Sacramento, so we weren't really close. But I'm really grateful to say that God decided to take care of her because they removed 90% of her stomach and the cancer is gone. You know, it's like I'm really extremely grateful. But walking through that process, again, it was about being at my meetings. It was about talking to people. And for me, a lot of times, it's about being of service and getting out of myself. It's like if I sit there in myself, I'll just start spinning in here, you know, all the what ifs and should I do this and should I do that, and you know. But if I go and do the next indicated thing for me in service, it's a whole lot easier. You know, I am involved with World Service. I am these days I'm the area Alateen process person, and that means I get to do the paperwork. Also means that I get to work on the Alateen behavioral requirements. And sometimes that's not fun either. You know, being of service has taught me a lot about how to work on things and about how to use a group conscience and then come back together even if we don't disagree. And it's amazing to me that that process is possible, and yet I've watched it happen over and over again. I also, and I haven't talked about this much, in fact, the people who are here that know me don't, most of them don't even know this yet, but my my oldest granddaughter, Sierra, who I mentioned earlier, had been living with her mom, and I'm afraid Sierra's been following in her mom's footsteps. And Sierra had a little baby about a year ago, and her name is Trinity, precious little baby girl, and Trinity just got removed from her mom and got sent back up to Alaska to live with Sierra's dad. And I've been going through that process, you know. Right now you're part of my process of coming to that place of the acknowledgement and the acceptance, you know. It's just sad to me. It is just sad to me that this disease doesn't stop. It just keeps going, and it doesn't matter how long I'm here. You know, I live in a household where I don't have any active alcoholism in my household, and sometimes people ask me, why do you keep going to Al-Anon? And I keep going to Al-Anon because life keeps happening. I keep going to Al-Anon because this is where I find my peace and serenity. This is where I find the strength to do life. And those people who don't have program, I don't know how they do it. I don't know how they do it, because this is my lifeline, so that I know that no matter what's going on in my life, I have my program. And I have the people in this program who are just so very special to me. I have this little group over here that are from my Thursday night meeting, and I'm so excited that they're here. And just the people that I've met, you know, all along the way, the people that, you know, I can look down and have so many great memories of this program. And, you know, and the great memories happened a lot of times when my life, my basic life, was in turmoil, and yet I can still have those really wonderful memories because the program gives that to me. So thank you all very much for being here. Thank you so much, Lorraine, for asking me to do this, and to the committee, and have fun this weekend. Thanks.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the Month Club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.